the bars. My husband thought Leroy wanted some more coffee, so he got up and went over and took the cup. Leroy was smiling as though everything was all right now. He wouldn't have to go to the electric chair after all. He'd cut off his whatchamacallit and put it in the cup. This book is made up, of course, but the story I had Bonnie tell actually happened in real life. In the death house of a penitentiary in Arkansas. As for Dwayne Hoover's dog Sparky, who couldn't wag his tail, Sparky is modeled after a dog my brother owns who has to fight all the time because he can't wag his tail. There really is such a dog. Rabbo Karabekian asked Bonnie McMahon to tell him something about the teenage girl on the cover of the program for the Festival of the Arts. This was the only internationally famous human being in Midland City. She was Mary Alice Miller, the woman's 200-meter breaststroke champion of the world. She was only 15, said Bonnie. Mary Alice was also the queen of the Festival of the Arts. The cover of the program showed her in a white bathing suit, with her Olympic gold medal hanging around her neck. Mary Alice was smiling at a picture of St. Sebastian by the Spanish painter El Greco. It had been loaned to the festival by Elliot Rosewater, the patron of Kilgore Trout. St. Sebastian was a Roman soldier who had lived 1,700 years before me and Mary Alice Miller and Wayne and Dwayne and all the rest of us. He had secretly become a Christian when Christianity was against the law, and somebody squealed on him. The Emperor Diocletian had him shot by archers. The picture Mary Alice smiled at with such uncritical bliss showed a human being who was so full of arrows that he looked like a porcupine. Something almost nobody knew about St. Sebastian, incidentally, since painters like to put so many arrows into him, was that he survived the incident. He actually got well. He walked around Rome praising Christianity and bad-mouthing the emperor, so he was sentenced to death a second time. He was beaten to death by rods. And so on. And Bonnie McMahon told Beatrice and Karabekian that Mary Alice's father, who was a member of the parole board out at Shepherdstown, had taught Mary Alice to swim when she was 8 months old, and that he had made her swim at least 4 hours a day, every day, since she was three. Rabbo Karabekian thought this over, and then he said loudly so a lot of people could hear him, "What kind of man would turn his daughter into an outboard motor?" And now comes the spiritual climax of this book, for it is at this point that I, the author, am suddenly transformed by what I have done so far. This is why I had gone to Midland City, to be born again. And Chaos announced that it was about to give birth to a new me by putting these words in the mouth of Rabbo Karabekian. What kind of man would turn his daughter into an outboard motor? Such a small remark was able to have such thundering consequences because the spiritual matrix of the cocktail lounge was in what I choose to call a pre-earthquake condition. Terrific forces were at work on our souls, but they could do no work because they balanced one another so nicely. But then a grain of sand crumbled. One force had a sudden advantage over another, and spiritual continents began to shrug and heave. One force, surely, was the lust for money, which infested so many people in the cocktail lounge. They knew what Rabbo Karabekian had been paid for his painting, and they wanted $50,000, too. They could have a lot of fun with $50,000, or so they believed, but they had to earn money the hard way, just a few dollars at a time instead. It wasn't right. Another force was the fear in these same people that their lives might be ridiculous, that their entire city might be ridiculous. Now the worst had happened. Mary Alice Miller, the one thing about their city which they had supposed was ridicule-proof, had just been lazily ridiculed by a man from out of town. And my own pre-earthquake condition must have been taken into consideration, too, since I was the one who was being reborn. Nobody else in the cocktail lounge was reborn, as far as I know. The rest got their minds changed, some of them, about the value of modern art. As for myself, I had come to the conclusion that there was nothing sacred about myself or about any human being, that we were all machines doomed to collide and collide and collide. For want of anything better to do, we became fans of collisions. Sometimes I wrote well about collisions, which meant I was a writing machine in good repair. Sometimes I wrote badly, which meant I was a writing machine in bad repair. I no more harbored sacredness than did a Pontiac, a mousetrap, or a South Bend lathe. I did not expect Rabbo Karabekian to rescue me. I had created him, and he was, in my opinion, a vain and weak and trashy man, no artist at all. But it is Rabbo Karabekian who made me the serene earthling which I am today. Listen. "What kind of man would turn his daughter into an outboard motor?" he said to Bonnie McMahon. Bonnie McMahon blew up. This was the first time she had blown up since she had come to work in the cocktail lounge. Her voice became as unpleasant as the noise of a bandsaw's cutting galvanized tin. It was loud, too. "Oh, yeah?" she said. "Oh, yeah?" Everybody froze. Bunny Hoover stopped playing the piano. Nobody wanted to miss a word. "You don't think much of Mary Alice Miller?" she said. "Well, we don't think much of your painting. I've seen better pictures done by a 5-year-old. Karabekian slid off his bar stool so he could face all those enemies standing up. He certainly surprised me. I expected him to retreat in a hail of olives, maraschino cherries, and lemon rinds, but he was majestic up there. "Listen," he said so calmly, "I have read the editorial against my painting in your wonderful newspaper. I have read every word of the hate mail you have been thoughtful enough to send to New York." This embarrassed people some. "The painting did not exist until I made it," Karabekian went on. "Now that it does exist, nothing would make me happier than to have it reproduced again and again and vastly improved upon by all the 5-year-olds in town. I would love for your children to find pleasantly and playfully what it took me many angry years to find. I now give you my word of honor," he went on, "that the picture your city owns shows everything about life which truly matters, with nothing left out. It is a picture of the awareness of every animal. It is the immaterial core of every animal, the I am to which all messages are sent. It is all that is alive in any of us, in a mouse, in a deer, in a cocktail waitress. It is unwavering and pure, no matter what preposterous adventure may befall us. A sacred picture of Saint Anthony alone is one vertical, unwavering band of light. If a cockroach were near him, or a cocktail waitress, the picture would show 2 such bands of light. Our awareness is all that is alive and may be sacred in any of us. Everything else about us is dead machinery. I have just heard from this cocktail waitress here, this vertical band of light, a story about her husband and an idiot who is about to be executed at Shepherdstown. Very well. Let a 5-year-old paint a sacred interpretation of that encounter. Let that 5-year-old strip away the idiocy, the bars, the waiting electric chair, the uniform of the guard, the gun of the guard, the bones and meat of the guard. What is that perfect picture which any 5-year-old can paint? 2 unwavering bands of light." Ecstasy bloomed on the barbaric face of Rabbo Karabekian. "Citizens of Midland City, I salute you," he said. "You have given a home to a masterpiece." Dwayne Hoover, incidentally, wasn't taking any of this in. He was still hypnotized, turned inward. He was thinking about moving fingers, writing, and moving on, and so forth. He had bats in his bell tower. He was off his rocker. He wasn't playing with a full deck of cards. 20. While my life was being renewed by the words of Rabbo Karabekian, Kilgore Trout found himself standing on the shoulder of the interstate, gazing across Sugar Creek in its concrete trough at the new Holiday Inn. There were no bridges across the creek. He would have to wade. So he sat down on a guardrail, removed his shoes and socks, rolled his pant legs to his knees. His bared shins were rococo with varicose veins and scars. So were the shins of my father when he was an old, old man. Kilgore Trout had my father's shins. They were a present from me. I gave him my father's feet, too, which were long and narrow and sensitive. They were azure. They were artistic feet. Trout lowered his artistic feet into the concrete trough containing Sugar Creek. They were coated at once with a clear plastic substance from the surface of the creek. When in some surprise, Trout lifted one coated foot from the water, the plastic substance dried in air instantly, sheathed his foot in a thin, skin-tight booty resembling mother of pearl. He repeated the process with his other foot. The substance was coming from the Barrytron plant. The company was manufacturing a new anti-personnel bomb for the Air Force. The bomb scattered plastic pellets instead of steel pellets because the plastic pellets were cheaper. They were also impossible to locate in the bodies of wounded enemies by means of X-ray machines. Barrytron had no idea it was dumping this waste into Sugar Creek. They had hired the Maritimo Brothers Construction Company, which was gangster-controlled, to build the system which would get rid of the waste. They knew the company was gangster-controlled. Everybody knew that. But the Maritimo brothers were usually the best builders in town. They had built Dwayne Hoover's house, for instance, which was a solid house. But every so often they would do something amazingly criminal. The Barrytron disposal system was a case in point. It was expensive, and it appeared to be complicated and busy. Actually, though, it was old junk hooked up every which way, concealing a straight run of stolen sewer pipe running directly from Barrytron to Sugar Creek. Barrytron would be absolutely sick when it learned what a polluter it had become. Throughout its history, it had attempted to be a perfect model of corporate good citizenship, no matter what it cost. Trout now crossed Sugar Creek on my father's legs and feet, and those appendages became more nacreous with every wading stride. He carried his parcels in his shoes and his socks on his head, although the water scarcely reached his kneecaps. He knew how ridiculous he looked. He expected to be received abominably, dreamed of embarrassing the festival to death. He had come all this distance for an orgy of masochism. He wanted to be treated like a cockroach. His situation, insofar as he was a machine, was complex, tragic, and laughable. But the sacred part of him, his awareness, remained an unwavering band of light. And this book is being written by a meat machine in cooperation with a machine made of metal and plastic. The plastic, incidentally, is a close relative of the gunk in Sugar Creek. And at the core of the writing meat machine is something sacred, which is an unwavering band of light. At the core of each person who reads this book is a band of unwavering light. My doorbell has just rung in my New York apartment, and I know what I will find when I open my front door. An unwavering band of light. God bless Rabo Karabikian. Listen. Kilgore Trout climbed out of the trough and onto the asphalt desert, which was the parking lot. It was his plan to enter the lobby of the inn on wet bare feet, to leave footprints on the carpet. It was Trout's fantasy that somebody would be outraged by the footprints. This would give him the opportunity to reply grandly, "What is it that offends you so? I am simply using man's first printing press. You are reading a bold and universal headline which says, I am here, I am here, I am here." But Trout was no walking printing press. His feet left no marks on the carpet because they were sheathed in plastic, and the plastic was dry. Here was the structure of the plastic molecule: CnCO, CH2, etc., etc., etc. The molecule went on and on and on, repeating itself forever to form a sheet both tough and poreless. This molecule was the monster Dwayne's twin stepbrothers, Lyle and Kyle, had attacked with their automatic shotguns. This was the same stuff which was fucking up Sacred Miracle Cave. The man who told me how to diagram a segment of a molecule of plastic was Professor Walter H. Stockmayer of Dartmouth College. He is a distinguished physical chemist and an amusing and useful friend of mine. I did not make him up. I would like to be Professor Walter H. Stockmayer. He is a brilliant pianist. He skis like a dream. And when he sketched a plausible molecule, he indicated points where it would go on and on, just as I have indicated them, with an abbreviation which means sameness without end. The proper ending for any story about people, it seems to me, since life is now a polymer in which the earth is wrapped so tightly, should be that same abbreviation, which I now write large because I feel like it, which is this one, etc. And it is in order to acknowledge the continuity of this polymer that I begin so many sentences with and so, and end so many paragraphs with and so on. It's all like an ocean, cried Dostoevsky. I say, it's all like cellophane. So Trout entered the lobby as an inkless printing press, but he was still the most grotesque human being who had ever come in there. All around him were what other people called mirrors, which he called leaks. The entire wall which separated the lobby from the cocktail lounge was a leak 10 feet high and 30 feet long. There was another leak on the cigarette machine and yet another on the candy machine. And when Trout looked through them to see what was going on in the other universe, he saw a red-eyed, filthy old creature who was barefoot, who had his pants rolled up to his knees. As it happened, the only other person in the lobby at the time was the beautiful young desk clerk, Milo Maritimo. Milo's clothing and skin and eyes were all the colors that olives can be. He was a graduate of the Cornell Hotel School. He was the homosexual grandson of Guillermo Little Willie Maritimo, a bodyguard of the notorious Chicago gangster, Al Capone. Trout presented himself to this harmless man, stood before his desk with his bare feet apart and his arms outspread. "The abominable snowman has arrived," he said to Milo. "If I'm not as clean as most abominable snowmen are, it is because I was kidnapped as a child from the slopes of Mount Everest and taken as a slave to a bordello in Rio de Janeiro, where I have been cleaning the unspeakably filthy toilets for the past 50 years. A visitor to our whipping room there screamed in a transport of agony and ecstasy that there was to be an arts festival in Midland City. I escaped on a rope of sheets taken from a reeking hamper. I have come to Midland City to have myself acknowledged before I die as the great artist I believe myself to be." Milo Maritimo greeted Trout with luminous adoration.
"Mr. Trout," he said in rapture, "I know you anywhere. Welcome to Midland City. We need you so."
"How do you know who I am?" said Kilgore Trout. No one had ever known who he was before.
"You had to be you," said Milo.
Trout was deflated, neutralized. He dropped his arms, became childlike now.
"Nobody ever knew who I was before," he said. "I know," said Milo. "We have discovered you, and we hope you will discover us. No longer will Midland City be known merely as the home of Mary Alice Miller, the women's 200-meter breaststroke champion of the world. It will also be the city which first acknowledged the greatness of Kilgore Trout."
Trout simply walked away from the desk and sat down on a brocaded Spanish-style settee. The entire lobby, except for the vending machines, was done in Spanish style. Milo now used a line from a television show which had been popular a few years back. The show wasn't on the air anymore, but most people still remember the line. Much of the conversation in the country consisted of lines from television shows, both past and present. The show Milo's line was from consisted of taking some old person, usually fairly famous, into what looked like an ordinary room, only it was actually a stage, with an audience out front and television cameras hidden all around. There were also people who had known the person in the older days hidden around. They would come out and tell anecdotes about the person later on. Milo now said what the master of ceremonies would have said to Trout if Trout had been on the show and the curtain was going up. "Kilgore Trout, this is your life." Only there wasn't any audience or curtain or any of that. And the truth was that Milo Maritimo was the only person in Midland City who knew anything about Kilgore Trout. It was wishful thinking on his part that the upper crust of Midland City was about to be as gaga as he was about the works of Kilgore Trout.
"We are so ready for a renaissance, Mr. Trout. You will be our Leonardo."
"How could you possibly have heard of me?" said Trout dazedly. "I'm getting ready for the Midland City Renaissance," said Milo. "I made it my business to read everything I could by and about every artist who was on his way here."
"There isn't anything by me or about me anywhere," protested Trout.
Milo came from behind his desk. He brought with him what appeared to be a lopsided old softball, swaddled in many different sorts of tape.
"When I couldn't find anything out about you," he said, "I wrote to Elliot Rosewater, the man who said we had to bring you here. He has a private collection of 41 of your novels and 63 of your short stories, Mr. Trout. He let me read them all."
He held out the seeming baseball, which was actually a book from Rosewater's collection. Rosewater used his science fiction library hard.
"This is the only book I haven't finished, and I'll finish it before the sun comes up tomorrow," said Milo.
The novel in question, incidentally, was The Smart Bunny. The leading character was a rabbit who lived like all other wild rabbits, but who was as intelligent as Albert Einstein or William Shakespeare. It was a female rabbit. She was the only female leading character in any novel or story by Kilgore Trout. She led a normal female rabbit's life despite her ballooning intellect. She concluded that her mind was useless, that it was a sort of tumor, that it had no usefulness within the rabbit scheme of things. So she went hippity-hop toward the city to have the tumor removed. But a hunter named Dudley Farrow shot and killed her before she got there. Farrow skinned her and took out her guts, but then he and his wife Grace decided that they had better not eat her because of her unusually large head. They thought what she had thought when she was alive, that she must be diseased. And so on. Kilgore Trout had to change into his only other garments, his high school tuxedo, and his new evening shirt and all right away. The lower parts of his rolled-up trousers had become impregnated with the plastic substance from the creek, so he couldn't roll them down again. They were stiff as flanges on sewer pipes. So Milo Maritimo showed him to his suite, which was two ordinary Holiday Inn rooms with a door between them open. Trout and every distinguished visitor had a suite,
with two color television sets, two tile baths, four double beds equipped with magic fingers. Magic fingers were electric vibrators attached to the mattress springs of the bed. If a guest put a quarter into a little box on his bedside table, the magic fingers would jiggle his bed. There were enough flowers in Trout's room for a Catholic gangster's funeral. They were from Fred T. Barry, the chairman of the Arts Festival, and from the Midland City Association of Women's Clubs, and from the Chamber of Commerce, and so on. Trout read a few of the cards on the flowers, and he commented, "The town certainly seems to be getting behind the arts in a great big way." Milo closed his olive eyes tight, wincing with a tangy agony. "It's time. Oh, God, Mr. Trout, we were starving for so long without even knowing what we were hungering for," he said. This young man was not only a descendant of master criminals, he was a close relative of felons operating in Midland City at the present time. The partners in the Maritimo Brothers Construction Company, for instance, were his uncles. Gino Maritimo, Milo's first cousin once removed, was the dope king of the city. "Oh, Mr. Trout," nice Milo went on, there in Trout's suite, "teach us to sing and dance and laugh and cry. We've tried to survive so long on money and sex and envy and real estate and football and basketball and automobiles and television and alcohol on sawdust and broken glass." "Open your eyes," said Trout bitterly. "Do I look like a dancer, a singer, a man of joy?" He was wearing his tuxedo now. It was a size too large for him. He had lost much weight since high school. His pockets were crammed with mothballs. They bulged like saddlebags. "Open your eyes," said Trout. "Would a man nourished by beauty look like this? You have nothing but desolation and desperation here, you say. I bring you more of the same." "My eyes are open," said Milo warmly, "and I see exactly what I expect to see. I see a man who is terribly wounded, because he has dared to pass through the fires of truth to the other side, which we have never seen. And then he has come back again to tell us about the other side." And I sat there in the new Holiday Inn and made it disappear, then appear again, then disappear, then appear again. Actually, there was nothing but a big open field there. A farmer had put it into rye. It was high time, I thought, for Trout to meet Dwayne Hoover, for Dwayne to run amok. I knew how this book would end. Dwayne would hurt a lot of people. He would bite off one joint of the right index finger of Kilgore Trout. And then Trout, with his wound dressed, would walk out into the unfamiliar city. He would meet his creator, who would explain everything. 21. Kilgore Trout entered the cocktail lounge. His feet were fiery hot. They were encased not only in shoes and socks, but in clear plastic, too. They could not sweat. They could not breathe. Rabo Karabikian and Beatrice Kiedsler did not see him come in. They were surrounded by new affectionate friends at the piano bar. Karabikian's speech had been splendidly received. Everybody agreed now that Midland City had one of the greatest paintings in the world. "All you had to do was explain," said Bonnie McMahon. "I understand now." "I don't think there was anything to explain," said Carlo Maritimo, the builder, wonderingly. "But there was, by God." Abe Cohen, the jeweler, said to Karabikian, "If artists would explain more, people would like art more. You realize that?" And so on. Trout was feeling spooky. He thought maybe a lot of people were going to greet him as effusively as Milo Maritimo had done. And he had had no experience with celebrations like that. But nobody got in his way. His old friend Anonymity was by his side again, and the two of them chose a table near Dwayne Hoover and me. All he could see of me was the reflection of candle flames in my mirrored glasses, in my leaks. Dwayne Hoover was still mentally absent from activities in the cocktail lounge. He sat like a lump of nose putty, staring at something long ago and far away. Dwayne moved his lips as Trout sat down. He was saying this soundlessly, and it had nothing to do with Trout or me. "Goodbye, Blue Monday." Trout had a fat manila envelope with him. Milo Maritimo had given it to him. It contained a program for the Festival of the Arts, a letter of welcome to Trout from Fred T. Barry, the chairman of the festival, a timetable of events during the coming week, and some other things. Trout also carried a copy of his novel, Now It Can Be Told. This was the wide-open beaver book which Dwayne Hoover would soon take so seriously. So there the three of us were. Dwayne and Trout and I could have been included in an equilateral triangle about 12 feet on a side. As three unwavering bands of light, we were simple and separate and beautiful. As machines, we were flabby bags of ancient plumbing and wiring, of rusty hinges and feeble springs. And our interrelationships were Byzantine. After all, I had created both Dwayne and Trout, and now Trout was about to drive Dwayne into full-blown insanity. And Dwayne would soon bite off the tip of Trout's finger. Wayne Hubler was watching us through a peephole in the kitchen. There was a tap on his shoulder. The man who had fed him now told him to leave. So he wandered outdoors, and he found himself among Duane's used cars again. He resumed his conversation with the traffic on the interstate. The bartender in the cocktail lounge now flicked on the ultraviolet lights in the ceiling. Bonnie McMahon's uniform, since it was impregnated with fluorescent materials, lit up like an electric sign. So did the bartender's jacket and the African masks on the walls. So did Duane Hoover's shirt and the shirts of several other men. The reason was this. Those shirts had been laundered in wash day products which contained fluorescent materials. The idea was to make clothes look brighter in sunlight by making them actually fluorescent. When the same clothes were viewed in a dark room under ultraviolet light, however, they became ridiculously bright. Bunny Hoover's teeth also lit up, since he used a toothpaste containing fluorescent materials, which was supposed to make his smile look brighter in daylight. He grinned now, and he appeared to have a mouthful of little Christmas tree lights. But the brightest new light in the room by far was the bosom of Kilgore Trout's new evening shirt. Its brilliance twinkled and had depth. It might have been the top of a slumping open sack of radioactive diamonds. But then Trout hunched forward involuntarily, buckling the starched shirt bosom, forming it into a parabolic dish. This made a searchlight of the shirt. Its beam was aimed at Duane Hoover. The sudden light roused Duane from his trance. He thought perhaps he had died. At any rate, something painless and supernatural was going on. Duane smiled trustingly at the holy light. He was ready for anything. Trout had no explanation for the fantastic transformation of certain garments around the room. Like most science fiction writers, he knew almost nothing about science. He had no more use for solid information than did Rabbo Karabekian, so now he could only be flabbergasted. My own shirt, being an old one, which had been washed many times in a Chinese laundry, which used ordinary soap, did not fluoresce. Duane Hoover now lost himself in the bosom of Trout's shirt, just as he had earlier lost himself in twinkling beads of lemon oil. He remembered now a thing his stepfather had told him when he was only 10 years old, which was this: why there were no niggers in Shepherdstown. This was not a completely irrelevant recollection. Duane had, after all, been talking to Bonnie McMahon, whose husband had lost so much money in a car wash in Shepherdstown. And the main reason the car wash had failed was that successful car washes needed cheap and plentiful labor, which meant black labor, and there were no niggers in Shepherdstown. Years ago, Duane's father told Duane when Duane was 10, niggers was coming up north by the millions to Chicago, to Midland City, to Indianapolis, to Detroit. The World War was going on. There was such a labor shortage that even niggers who couldn't read or write could get good factory jobs. Niggers had money like they never had before. Over at Shepherdstown, though, he went on, the white people got smart quick. They didn't want niggers in their town, so they put up signs on the main roads at the city limits and in the railroad yard. Duane's stepfather described the signs, which said, "Nigger, this is Shepherdstown. God help you if the sun ever sets on you here." One night, Duane's stepfather said, a nigger family got off a boxcar in Shepherdstown. Maybe they didn't see the sign, maybe they couldn't read it, maybe they couldn't believe it. Duane's stepfather was out of work when he told the story so gleefully. The Great Depression had just begun. He and Duane were on a weekly expedition in the family car, hauling garbage and trash out into the country, where they dumped it all in Sugar Creek. Anyway, they moved into an empty shack that night, Duane's stepfather went on. They got a fire going in the stove and all, so a mob went down there at midnight. They took out the man and they sawed him in two on top of the strand of barbed wire fence. Duane remembered clearly that a rainbow of oil from the trash was spreading prettily over the surface of Sugar Creek when he heard that. Since that night, which was a long time ago now, his stepfather said, there ain't never been a nigger even spend the night in Shepherdstown. Trout was itchingly aware that Duane was staring at his bosom so lunily. Duane's eyes swam, and Trout supposed they were swimming in alcohol. He could not know that Duane was seeing an oil slick on Sugar Creek, which had made rainbows 40 long years ago. Trout was aware of me, too, what little he could see of me. I made him even more uneasy than Duane did. The thing was, Trout was the only character I ever created who had enough imagination to suspect that he might be the creation of another human being. He had spoken of this possibility several times to his parakeet. He had said, for instance, "Honest to God, Bill, the way things are going, all I can think of is that I'm a character in a book by somebody who wants to write about somebody who suffers all the time." Now Trout was beginning to catch on that he was sitting very close to the person who had created him. He was embarrassed. It was hard for him to know how to respond, particularly since his responses were going to be anything I said they were. I went easy on him, didn't wave, didn't stare. I kept my glasses on. I wrote again on my tabletop, scrawled the symbols for the interrelationship between matter and energy, as it was understood in my day, E equals mc squared. It was a flawed equation, as far as I was concerned. There should have been an A in there somewhere for awareness, without which the E and the M and the C, which was a mathematical constant, could not exist. All of us were stuck to the surface of a ball, incidentally. The planet was ball-shaped. Nobody knew why we didn't fall off, even though everybody pretended to kind of understand it. The really smart people understood that one of the best ways to get rich was to own a part of the surface people had to stick to. Trout dreaded eye contact with either Duane or me, so he went through the contents of the manila envelope which had been waiting for him in his suite. The first thing he examined was a letter from Fred T. Barry, the chairman of the Festival of the Arts, the donor of the Mildred Barry Memorial Center for the Arts, and the founder and chairman of the board of directors of Barrytron Limited. Clipped to the letter was one share of common stock in Barrytron made out in the name of Kilgore Trout. Here was the letter. "Dear Mr. Trout," it said, "it is a pleasure and an honor to have such a distinguished and creative person give his precious time to Midland City's first Festival of the Arts. It is our wish that you feel like a member of our family while you are here. To give you and other distinguished visitors a deeper sense of participation in the life of our community, I am making a gift to each of you of one share in the company which I founded, the company of which I am now chairman of the board. It is not only my company now, but yours as well. Our company began as the Robo Magic Corporation of America in 1934. It had 3 employees in the beginning, and its mission was to design and manufacture the first fully automatic washing machine for use in the home. You will find the motto of that washing machine on the corporate emblem at the top of the stock certificate. The emblem consisted of a Greek goddess on an ornate chaise lounge. She held a flagstaff from which a long pennant streamed. Here is what the pennant said. Goodbye, Blue Monday." The motto of the old robo-magic washing machine cleverly confused 2 separate ideas people had about Monday. One idea was that women traditionally did their laundry on Monday. Monday was simply wash day, and not an especially depressing day on that account. People who had horrible jobs during the week used to call Monday Blue Monday sometimes, though because they hated to return to work after a day of rest. When Fred T. Barry made up the robo-magic motto as a young man, he pretended that Monday was called Blue Monday, because doing the laundry disgusted and exhausted women. The robo-magic was going to cheer them up. It wasn't true, incidentally, that most women did their laundry on Monday at the time the robo-magic was invented. They did it any time they felt like it. One of Duane Hoover's clearest recollections from the Great Depression, for instance, was when his stepmother decided to do the laundry on Christmas Eve. She was bitter about the low estate to which the family had fallen, and she suddenly clumped down into the basement, down among the black beetles and the millipedes, and did the laundry. "Time to do the nigger work," she said. Fred T. Barry began advertising the robo-magic in 1933, long before there was a reliable machine to sell. And he's one of the few persons in Midland City who could afford billboard advertising during the Great Depression, so the robo-magic sales message did not have to jostle and shriek for attention. It was practically the only symbol in town. One of Fred's ads was on the billboard outside the main gate of the defunct Keitzler Automobile Company, which the robo-magic corporation had taken over. It showed a high society woman in a fur coat and pearls. She was leaving her mansion for a pleasant afternoon of idleness, and a balloon was coming out of her mouth. These were the words in the balloon: "Off to the bridge club, while my robo-magic does the wash. Goodbye, Blue Monday." Another ad, which was painted on a billboard by the railroad depot, showed 2 white delivery men who were bringing a robo-magic into a house. A black maid was watching them. Her eyes were popping out in a comical way. There was a balloon coming out of her mouth, too, and she was saying this: "Feet's get movin'. They's got theirselves a robo-magic. They ain't gonna be needin' us round here no mo'." Fred T. Barry wrote these ads himself, and he predicted at the time that robo-magic appliances of various sorts would eventually do what he called all the nigger work of the world, which was lifting and cleaning and cooking and washing and ironing and tending children and dealing with filth. Duane Hoover's stepmother wasn't the only white woman who was a terrible sport about doing work like that. My own mother was that way, too, and so was my sister, may she rest in peace. They both flatly refused to do nigger work. The white men wouldn't do it either, of course. They called it women's work, and the women called it nigger work. I am going to make a wild guess now. I think that the end of the Civil War in my country frustrated the white people in the North who won it in a way which has never been acknowledged before. Their descendants inherited that frustration, I think, without ever knowing what it was. The victors in that war were cheated out of the most desirable spoils of that war, which were human slaves. The robo-magic dream was interrupted by World War II. The old Keitzler Automobile Works became an armory instead of an appliance factory. All that survived of the robo-magic itself was its brain, which had told the rest of the machine when to let the water in, when to let the water out, when to slosh, when to rinse, when to spin dry, and so on. That brain became the nerve center of the so-called blink system during the Second World War. It was installed on heavy bombers, and it did the actual dropping of bombs after a bombardier pressed his bright red bombs away button. The button activated the blink system, which then released the bombs in such a way as to achieve a desired pattern of explosions on the planet below. Blink was an abbreviation of Blast Interval Normalization Computer. 22. And I sat there in the cocktail lounge of the New Holiday Inn, watching Dwayne Hoover stare into the bosom of the shirt of Kilgore Trout. I was wearing a bracelet which said, W01 John Sparks, 3-1971. W01 stood for Warrant Officer First Class, which was the rank of John Sparks. The bracelet had cost me $2.50. It was a way of expressing my pity for the hundreds of Americans who had been taken prisoner during the war in Vietnam. Such bracelets were becoming popular. Each one bore the name of an actual prisoner of war, his rank, and the date of his capture. Wearers of the bracelets weren't supposed to take them off until the prisoners came home or were reported dead or missing. I wondered how I might fit my bracelet into my story and hit on the good idea of dropping it somewhere for Wayne Hubler to find. Wayne would assume that it belonged to a woman who loved somebody named W01 John Sparks, and that the woman and W01 had become engaged or married or something important on March 19, 1971. Wayne would mouth the usual first name tentatively. Wee, he would say. Woe-wee. Woe-wye. Woy. There in the cocktail lounge, I gave Dwayne Hoover credit for having taken a course in speed reading at night at the Young Men's Christian Association. This would enable him to read Kilgore Trout's novel in minutes instead of hours. There in the cocktail lounge, I took a white pill, which a doctor said I could take in moderation, 2 a day, in order not to feel blue. There in the cocktail lounge, the pill and the alcohol gave me a terrific sense of urgency about explaining all the things I hadn't explained yet, and then hurtling on with my tale. Let's see. I have already explained Dwayne's uncharacteristic ability to read so fast. Kilgore Trout probably couldn't have made his trip from New York City in the time I allotted, but it's too late to bugger around with that. Let it stand. Let it stand. Let's see. Let's see. Oh, yes. I have to explain a jacket Trout will see at the hospital. It will say this on the back. Innocent bystander H.S. Here is the explanation. There used to be only one nigger high school in Midland City, and it was an all-nigger high school still. It was named after Crispus Attucks, a black man who was shot by British troops in Boston in 1770. There was an oil painting of this event in the main corridor of the school. Several white people were stopping bullets, too. Crispus Attucks himself had a hole in his forehead, which looked like the front door of a birdhouse. But the black people didn't call the school Crispus Attucks High School anymore. They called it Innocent Bystander High. And when another nigger high school was built after the Second World War, it was named after George Washington Carver, a black man who was born into slavery, but who became a famous chemist anyway. He discovered many remarkable new uses for peanuts. But the black people wouldn't call that school by its proper name either. On the day it opened, there were already young black people wearing jackets which said this on the back, Peanut University. I have to explain, too, see, why so many black people in Midland City were able to imitate birds from various parts of what used to be the British Empire. The thing was, see, that Fred T. Barry and his mother and father were almost the only people in Midland City who could afford to hire niggers to do the nigger work during the Great Depression. They took over the old Keitzler mansion where Beatrice Keitzler, the novelist, had been born. They had as many as 20 servants working there all at one time. Fred's father got so much money during the prosperity of the 20s as a bootlegger and as a swindler in stocks and bonds. He kept all his money in cash, which turned out to be a bright thing to do since so many banks failed during the Great Depression. Also, Fred's father was an agent for Chicago gangsters who wanted to buy legitimate businesses for their children and grandchildren. Through Fred's father, those gangsters bought almost every desirable property in Midland City for anything from a tenth to a hundredth of what it was really worth. And before Fred's mother and father came to the United States after the First World War, they were music hall entertainers in England. Fred's father played the musical saw. His mother imitated birds from various parts of what was still the British Empire. She went on imitating them for her own amusement well into the Great Depression. "The bulbul of Malaysia," she would say, for instance, and then she would imitate that bird. "The moorpark owl of New Zealand," she would say, and then she would imitate that bird. And all the black people who worked for her thought her act was the funniest thing they'd ever seen, though they never laughed out loud when she did it. And, in order to double up their friends and relatives with laughter, they too learned how to imitate the birds. The craze spread. Black people who had never been near the Keitzler Mansion could imitate the lyrebird and the willy wagtail of Australia, the golden oriole of India, the nightingale, and the chaffinch, and the wren, and the chiff-chaff of England itself. They could even imitate the happy screech of the extinct companion of Kilgore Trout's island childhood, which was the Bermuda Ern. When Kilgore Trout hit town, the black people could still imitate those birds and say word for word what Fred's mother had said before each imitation. If one of them imitated a nightingale, for instance, he or she would say this first: "What adds peculiar beauty to the call of the nightingale, much beloved by poets, is the fact that it will only sing by moonlight," and so on. There in the cocktail lounge, Duane Hoover's bad chemicals suddenly decided that it was time for Duane to demand from Kilgore Trout the secrets of life. "Give me the message," cried Duane. He tottered up from his own banquette, crashed down again next to Trout, throwing off heat like a steam radiator. "The message, please." And here Duane did something extraordinarily unnatural. He did it because I wanted him to. It was something I had ached to have a character do for years and years. Duane did to Trout what the Duchess did to Alice in Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. He rested his chin on poor Trout's shoulder, dug in with his chin. "The message," he said, digging in his chin, digging in his chin. Trout made no reply. He had hoped to get through what little remained of his life without ever having to touch another human being again. Duane's chin on his shoulder was as shattering as buggery to Trout. "Is this it? Is this it?" said Duane, snatching up Trout's novel, Now It Can Be Told. "Yes, that's it," croaked Trout. To his tremendous relief, Duane removed his chin from his shoulder. Duane now began to read hungrily, as though starved for print, and the speed reading course he had taken at the Young Men's Christian Association allowed him to make a perfect pig of himself with pages and words. "Dear sir, poor sir, brave sir," he read, "you are an experiment by the creator of the universe. You are the only creature in the entire universe who has free will. You are the only one who has to figure out what to do next and why. Everyone else is a robot, a machine. Some persons seem to like you and others seem to hate you, and you must wonder why. They are simply liking machines and hating machines. You are pooped and demoralized," read Duane. "Why wouldn't you be? Of course it is exhausting having to reason all the time in a universe which wasn't meant to be reasonable." 23. Duane Hoover read on. "You are surrounded by loving machines, hating machines, greedy machines, unselfish machines, brave machines, cowardly machines, truthful machines, lying machines, funny machines, solemn machines," he read. "Their only purpose is to stir you up in every conceivable way so the creator of the universe can watch your reactions. They can no more feel or reason than grandfather clocks. The creator of the universe would now like to apologize not only for the capricious, jostling companionship he provided during the test, but for the trashy, stinking condition of the planet itself. The creator programmed robots to abuse it for millions of years, so it would be a poisonous, festering cheese when you got here. Also, he made sure it would be desperately crowded by programming robots, regardless of their living conditions, to crave sexual intercourse and adore infants more than almost anything." Mary Alice Miller, incidentally, the women's breaststroke champion of the world and queen of the arts festival, now passed through the cocktail lounge.
She made a shortcut to the lobby from the side parking lot where her father was waiting for her in his Avocado 1970 Plymouth Barracuda Fastback, which he had bought as a used car from Duane. It had a new car guarantee. Mary Alice's father, Don Miller, was, among other things, chairman of the Board of Parole at Shepherdstown. It was he who had decided that Wayne Hubler, lurking among Duane's used cars again, was fit to take his place in society. Mary Alice went into the lobby to get a crown and scepter for her performance as queen at the Arts Festival banquet that night. Milo Maritimo, the desk clerk, the gangster's grandson, had made them with his own two hands. Her eyes were permanently inflamed. They looked like maraschino cherries. Only one person noticed her sufficiently to comment out loud. He was Abe Cohen, the jeweler. He said this about Mary Alice, despising her sexlessness and innocence and empty mind. Pure tuna fish. Kilgore Trout heard him say that about pure tuna fish. His mind tried to make sense of it. His mind was swamped with mysteries. He might as well have been Wayne Hubler, adrift among Duane's used cars during Hawaiian week. His feet, which were sheathed in plastic, were meanwhile getting hotter all the time. The heat was painful now. His feet were curling and twisting, begging to be plunged into cold water or waved in the air. And Duane read on about himself and the creator of the universe, to wit. He also programmed robots to write books and magazines and newspapers for you, and television and radio shows and stage shows and films. They wrote songs for you. The creator of the universe had them invent hundreds of religions so you would have plenty to choose among. He had them kill each other by the millions for this purpose only, that you be amazed. They have committed every possible atrocity and every possible kindness unfeelingly, automatically, inevitably, to get a reaction from Y.O.U. This last word was set in extra-large type and had a line all to itself. Every time you went into the library, said the book, the creator of the universe held his breath. With such a higgly-piggly cultural smorgasbord before you, what would you with your free will choose? Your parents were fighting machines and self-pitying machines, said the book. Your mother was programmed to bawl out your father for being a defective money-making machine, and your father was programmed to bawl her out for being a defective housekeeping machine. They were programmed to bawl each other out for being defective loving machines. Then your father was programmed to stomp out of the house and slam the door. This automatically turned your mother into a weeping machine. And your father would go down to a tavern where he would get drunk with some other drinking machines. Then all the drinking machines would go to a whorehouse and rent fucking machines. And then your father would drag himself home to become an apologizing machine. And your mother would become a very slow, forgiving machine. Duane got to his feet now, having wolfed down tens of thousands of words of such solipsistic whimsy in 10 minutes or so. He walked stiffly over to the piano bar. What made him stiff was his awe of his own strength and righteousness. He dared not use his full strength in merely walking, for fear of destroying the new Holiday Inn with footfalls. He did not fear for his own life. Trout's book assured him that he had already been killed 23 times. On each occasion, the creator of the universe had patched him up and got him going again. Duane restrained himself in the name of elegance rather than safety. He was going to respond to his new understanding of life with finesse, for an audience of two, himself and his creator. He approached his homosexual son. Bunny saw the trouble coming, supposed it was death. He might have protected himself easily with all the techniques of fighting he had learned in military school, but he chose to meditate instead. He closed his eyes, and his awareness sank into the silence of the unused lobes of his mind. The phosphorescent scarf floated by. It said, "Cool." Duane shoved Bunny's head from behind. He rolled it like a cantaloupe up and down the keys of the piano bar. Duane laughed, and he called his son a goddamn cock-sucking machine. Bunny did not resist him, even though Bunny's face was being mangled horribly. Duane hauled his head from the keys, slammed it down again. There was blood on the keys, and spit, and mucus. Rabo Karabekian and Beatrice Keedsler and Bonnie McMahon all grabbed Duane now, pulled him away from Bunny. This increased Duane's glee. "Never hit a woman, right?" he said to the creator of the universe. He then socked Beatrice Keedsler on the jaw. He punched Bonnie McMahon in the belly. He honestly believed that they were unfeeling machines. "All you robots want to know why my wife ate Drano?" Duane asked his thunderstruck audience. "I'll tell you why. She was that kind of machine." There was a map of Duane's rampage in the paper the next morning. The dotted line of his route started in the cocktail lounge, crossed the asphalt to Francine Pefko's office in his automobile agency, doubled back to the new Holiday Inn again, then crossed Sugar Creek and the westbound lane of the interstate to the median divider, which was grass. Duane was subdued on the median divider by two state policemen who happened by. Here is what Duane said to the policeman as they cuffed his hands behind his back. "Thank God you're here." Duane didn't kill anybody on his rampage, but he hurt 11 people so badly they had to go to the hospital. And on the map in the newspaper, there was a mark indicating each place where a person had been injured seriously. In the newspaper map of Duane's rampage, there were three such crosses inside the cocktail lounge for Bunny and Beatrice Kiedsler and Bonnie McMahon. Then Duane ran out onto the asphalt between the inn and his used car lot. He yelled for niggers out there, telling them to come at once. "I want to talk to you," he said. He was out there all alone. Nobody from the cocktail lounge had followed him yet. Mary Alice Miller's father, Don Miller, was in his car near Duane, waiting for Mary Alice to come back with her crown and scepter, but he never saw anything of the show Duane put on. His car had seats whose backs could be made to lie flat. They could be made into beds. Don was lying on his back, with his head well below window level, resting, staring at the ceiling. He was trying to learn French by means of listening to lessons recorded on tape. "Demain nous allons passer la soirée au cinéma," said the tape, and Don tried to say it too. "Nous espérons que notre grand père vivra encore longtemps," said the tape. And so on. Duane went on calling for niggers to come to talk to him. He smiled. He thought that the creator of the universe had programmed them all to hide, as a joke. Duane glanced around craftily, then he called out a signal he had used as a child to indicate that a game of hide-and-seek was over, that it was time for children in hiding to go home. Here's what he called, and the sun was down when he called it. "Ollie, ollie, oxen free." The person who answered this incantation was a person who had never played hide-and-seek in his life. It was Wayne Hubler, who came out from among the used cars quietly. He clasped his hands behind his back and placed his feet apart. He assumed the position known as parade rest. This position was taught to soldiers and prisoners alike as a way of demonstrating attentiveness, gullibility, respect, and voluntary defenselessness. He was ready for anything and wouldn't mind death. "There you are," said Duane, and his eyes crinkled in bittersweet amusement. He didn't know who Wayne was. He welcomed him as a typical black robot. Any other black robot would have served as well. And Duane again carried on a wry talk with the creator of the universe, using a robot as an unfeeling conversation piece. A lot of people in Midland City put useless objects from Hawaii or Mexico or someplace like that on their coffee tables or their living room end tables or on whatnot shelves, and such an object was called a conversation piece. Wayne remained at parade rest while Duane told of his year as a county executive for the Boy Scouts of America, when more young black people were brought into scouting than in any previous year. Duane told Wayne about his efforts to save the life of a young black man named Peyton Brown, who at the age of 15 and a half became the youngest person ever to die in the electric chair at Shepherdstown. Duane rambled on about all the black people he had hired when nobody else would hire black people, about how they never seemed to be able to get to work on time. He mentioned a few, too, who had been energetic and punctual, and he winked at Wayne, and he said this: they were programmed that way. He spoke of his wife and son again, acknowledged that white robots were just like black robots, essentially, and that they were programmed to be whatever they were, to do whatever they did. Duane was silent for a moment after that. Mary Alice Miller's father was meanwhile continuing to learn conversational French while lying down in his automobile only a few yards away. And then Duane took a swing at Wayne. He meant to slap him hard with his open hand, but Wayne was very good at ducking. He dropped to his knees as the hand swished through the air where his face had been. Duane laughed. "African Dodger," he said. This had reference to a sort of carnival booth, which was popular when Duane was a boy. A black man would stick his head through a hole in a piece of canvas at the back of a booth, and people would pay money for the privilege of throwing hard baseballs at his head. If they hit his head, they won a prize. So Duane thought that the creator of the universe had invited him to play a game of African Dodger now. He became cunning, concealed his violent intentions with apparent boredom. Then he kicked at Wayne very suddenly. Wayne dodged again, and had to dodge yet again, almost instantly, as Duane advanced with quick combinations of intended kicks, slaps, and punches. And Wayne vaulted onto the bed of a very unusual truck, which had been built on the chassis of a 1962 Cadillac limousine, It had belonged to the Maritimo Brothers Construction Company. Wayne's new elevation gave him a view past Duane of both barrels of the interstate and of a mile or more of Will Fairchild Memorial Airport, which lay beyond. And it is important to understand at this point that Wayne had never seen an airport before, was unprepared for what could happen to an airport when a plane came in at night. "That's all right, that's all right," Duane assured Wayne. He was being a very good sport. He had no intention of climbing up on a truck for another swing at Wayne. He was winded, for one thing. For another, he understood that Wayne was a perfect dodging machine. Only a perfect hitting machine could hit him. "You're too good for me," said Duane. So Duane backed away some, contented himself with preaching up at Wayne. He spoke about human slavery, not only black slaves, but white slaves, too. Duane regarded coal miners and workers on assembly lines and so forth as slaves, no matter what color they were. "I used to think that was such a shame," he said. "I used to think the electric chair was a shame. I used to think war was a shame, and automobile accidents, and cancer," he said, and so on. He didn't think they were shames anymore. "Why should I care what happens to machines?" he said. Wayne Hubler's face had been blank so far, but now it began to bloom with uncontrollable awe. His mouth fell open. The runway lights of Will Fairchild Memorial Airport had just come on. Those lights looked like miles and miles of bewilderingly beautiful jewelry to Wayne. He was seeing a dream come true on the other side of the interstate. The inside of Wayne's head lit up in recognition of that dream, lit up with an electric sign which gave a childish name to the dream. It said, Fairyland. 24. Listen. Duane Hoover hurt so many people seriously that a special ambulance known as Martha was called. Martha was a full-size General Motors transcontinental bus, but with the seats removed. There were beds for 36 disaster victims in there, plus a kitchen and a bathroom and an operating room. It had enough food and medical supplies aboard to serve as an independent little hospital for a week, without help from the outside world. Its full name was the Martha Simmons Memorial Mobile Disaster Unit, named in honor of the wife of Newbolt Simmons, a county commissioner of public safety. She had died of rabies contracted from a sick bat she found clinging to her floor-to-ceiling living room draperies one morning. She had just been reading a biography of Albert Schweitzer, who believed that human beings should treat simpler animals lovingly. The bat nipped her ever so lightly as she wrapped it in Kleenex, a face tissue. She carried it out onto her patio, where she laid it gently on a form of artificial grass known as astroturf. She had 36-inch hips, a 29-inch waist, and a 38-inch bosom at the time of her death. Her husband had a penis 7.5 inches long and 2 inches in diameter. He and Duane were drawn together for a while because his wife and Duane's wife had died such strange deaths within a month of each other. They bought a gravel pit together out on Route 23A, but then the Maritimo Brothers Construction Company offered them twice what they had paid for it. So they accepted the offer and divided up the profits, and the friendship petered out somehow. They still exchanged Christmas cards. Duane's most recent Christmas card to Newbolt Simmons said this, Noel. Newbolt Simmons' most recent Christmas card to Duane said this, Season's greetings. My psychiatrist is also named Martha. She gathers jumpy people together into little families, which meet once a week. It's a lot of fun. She teaches us how to comfort one another intelligently. She is on vacation now. I like her a lot. And I think now, as my 50th birthday draws near, about the American novelist Thomas Wolfe, who was only 38 years old when he died. He got a lot of help in organizing his novels from Maxwell Perkins, his editor at Charles Scribner's Sons. I have heard that Perkins told him to keep in mind as he wrote, as a unifying idea, a hero's search for a father. It seems to me that really truthful American novels would have the heroes and heroines alike looking for mothers instead. This needn't be embarrassing. It's simply true. A mother is much more useful. I wouldn't feel particularly good if I found another father. Neither would Duane Hoover. Neither would Kilgore Trout. And just as motherless Duane Hoover was berating motherless Wayne Hubler in the used car lot, a man who had actually killed his mother was preparing to land in a chartered plane at Will Fairchild Memorial Airport on the other side of the interstate. This was Elliot Rosewater, Kilgore Trout's patron. He killed his mother accidentally in a boating accident when a youth. She was women's chess champion of the United States of America 1936 years after the Son of God was born, supposedly. Rosewater killed her the year after that. It was his pilot who caused the airport's runways to become an ex-convict's ideas of fairyland. Rosewater remembered his mother's jewelry when the lights came on. He looked to the west, and he smiled at the rosy loveliness of the Mildred Barry Memorial Arts Center, a harvest moon on stilts in a bend of Sugar Creek. It reminded him of how his mother had looked when he saw her through the bleary eyes of infancy.